Hey, all. I am Catherine Spires, host of Smart Mouth. Before we get to today's episode, I'll tell you about the Smart Mouth social media. We're in a Facebook group, not a page. I mean, there is a page, but go to the group. It's better. You can search for it at Smart Mouth, which is two words, and ask to be added, and that will happen shortly. The podcast is also on Instagram at Smart Mouth Podcast. And Smart Mouth is on Patreon. If you want to go check out the levels there, see what I'm doing, trying to finance an upcoming Smart Mouth newsletter, that would be great. The page is patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast. This week's replay guest is Andrea Nguyen. Since this episode originally aired, she's written yet another cookbook called Vietnamese Food Any Day. You can see all of her work at vietworldkitchen.com. In this episode, we talk about pho, which she is wildly knowledgeable about, just wildly. It's incredible. I think you'll enjoy it. And if you are enjoying this podcast, please tell a friend about it. Now, on to the show. Everybody, welcome to this week's edition of Smart Mouth, the podcast where we find out more about our favorite people by talking to them about their favorite foods. And if you like the show, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. And now let's get into it. We are here with Andrea Nguyen. She is the author of a few books, but most importantly for today's purposes, the Pho Cookbook, which is brand new. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me today.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for coming on. I'm really excited to talk to you about pho. And part of the discussion is going to be like, am I pronouncing it correctly?
You are doing very, very well.
That is...
because the British like to say fur.
Fur. Okay, but you know, I've heard some people get really pedantic and say that that's the way it's meant to be pronounced.
Well, if you want to like really impress a Vietnamese speaker, you would say pho.
Okay, you sort of elongate it.
And make it an interrogative, a question mark. So you can always say, I would like some pho.
Oh, that's a good tip.
Yeah.
I like that pro tip. But it's okay that a California girl can just say pho.
Pho. Well, not just pho. For sure. But if you say pho, sure, you'd be like...
Right.
You'd probably get like extra broth or something.
Aw. But never pho.
No bueno.
Yeah, it just has no role in the discussion whatsoever.
Well, it's hard, you know, because pho became part of the English language dictionary. And so all of those little funny accent marks over it are no longer needed when you use it in, you know, an English language sentence. You can drop that.
Oh.
Like, banh mi is now, you know, like, you don't have to use those little diacritics. So when people say that, you know, it's just like, hey, pho, they're just being English speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay.
Oh, yeah.
As long
trying
as
their best,
exactly,
maybe.
Exactly. They're just trying it, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm all right.
I definitely want to talk more about the etymology of these words because you also brought up banh mi and that's something else I want to touch on. But first, let's talk about you.
What would you like to know?
Everything. Let's talk about why you've made your career in food, like the whole backstory.
Well, I started writing about food here in LA. I was working at USC and in a relatively boring administrative position. And I'd been cooking ever since I was a kid, like 10 years old. If I could read a cookbook, I went to the library and picked up cookbooks. And I always wanted to write a Vietnamese cookbook because I thought, gosh, all the cookbooks that I saw out there, they didn't have recipes that looked like what my family made.
Okay.
They had like these really long ingredient lists that like made my eyes glaze over and they really didn't tell the story of Vietnamese people coming to America and how Vietnamese people preserve their heritage through food.
Are you talking about any cookbooks or Vietnamese food cookbooks?
Vietnamese food cookbooks.
Okay.
And so I wanted to be able to tell that story, except I didn't like, you know, have any background in professional cooking whatsoever.
I see.
But there were like some, you know, really funny little Asian American magazines that started here in LA that said, yeah, you know, we'll pay you a very small amount of money to write like restaurant reviews. Just go out there and whatever you want to write about, we'll just take it.
Okay.
And so I did a little bit of that. And I had a cookbook project that I was shopping for a number of years, and I couldn't place it because I was told by agents that the idea was great to write a Vietnamese cookbook. They'd love to see it in print, but I needed to be on television to get a contract.
Amazing.
And so they couldn't sell it. So I moved to Northern California from Santa Monica, where we were living in a rent-controlled apartment.
So you decided to just go the complete opposite direction of all this advice.
Yeah.
You moved from TV land to the hippie wilds.
To the redwoods.
Yeah.
And I gardened and I, you know, churned butter.
You lived that full Santa Cruz life.
Yeah, I did. And miraculously, I ended up just building my own website, vietworldkitchen.com, in the early 2000s, because I thought, hell, if I cannot get a book contract, I'm just going to build this hub for Vietnamese food information.
Love it.
So I just did it from scratch. And in a very odd twist of fate, I met the owner of 10 Speed Press, which at that time I already knew was like one of the best cookbook publishing companies in America. And they particularly liked Vietnamese cookbooks. So Phil Wood was a man who dressed in Hawaiian print pajama outfits.
Okay.
That was like his uniform.
All right.
And he was quirky. And he and his top editors snatched up the book right away. And so Into the Vietnamese Kitchen came out in 2006. And it was my first book. And it's like my firstborn. You know, you have your first album, your first child, and it'll always be very, very special.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. So how do you think that you can sort of track an increasing understanding of Vietnamese food in America from when your first book was published 10 years ago, 11 years ago?
You know, there were Vietnamese cookbooks before mine, so I will concede to that. But I think that because I had a high visibility and I just kept pushing it online through the website, and I'm not one of these people who are like a power blogger and stuff like that, but eventually friends of mine who were in high profile blogging in food said, you need to have a blog if you're going to be successful. So I turned the website vietworldkitchen.com into a blog.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always there to answer people's questions. And, you know, in the past when people wrote books, cookbooks, they were just able to kind of like write them, teach classes, and not really engage all the time. But back in like 2006, 2007, that was like, you know, the beginning of like the immediate engagement with your audience.
And I have seen on your website that when people ask you questions in the comment section, you actually answered.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, and that takes so much work. People don't realize, but they're asking for free labor for you every time they ask for a trip, you know, tips and tricks.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of free information that gets dispensed and it builds goodwill. And, you know, sometimes it seems like a lot of work, but then sometimes I learn a lot from people too, because they'll share their experiences. And I always tell people with the website that I want them to contribute information to me too. But there's always a point nowadays where there's just so much food information out there that people expect things for free. And I try to emphasize to my audience that this is not a hobby for me. I'm like very serious about what I do. And in terms of the research and in terms of the recipe testing, I just don't, you know, think of these things. I'm not a kitchen rock star, as some people say. I really work very hard at it.
Uh-huh.
And I screw up. I fuck up so much. And I fuck up. People don't even know that I fuck up, but I screw up. And people, and I wanted people to know that it's okay for them to screw up too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that, you know, because I think that you can learn a lot about humanity through food. And I think nowadays through social media, it's a way for all of us to be engaged in that conversation. And, you know, it takes a lot of work, but then you learn to type fast. Those thumbs, you know, they get a lot of big workout.
Yeah. So you feel like it pays off. Because I think it's actually kind of similar to podcasting. It's the collaborative spirit of it all that people really respond to when it comes to online content.
Yeah. It's just, you know, I was just talking to my husband before we got here that there's just always this thing of like people want free recipes and they'll say things to me like if I post a photo of something, they'll say recipe please. And it's very in a very demanding way. And I think I feel guilty because I'm a person who wants to please people, but at the same time, it takes me an inordinate amount of time to come up with a recipe that's ready for prime time. And I think what people also fail to realize is the stuff that is online isn't as rigorously tested as stuff that's printed in a book.
Sure.
And the book experience is an experience that's kind of random and it's storytelling and it's a very three-dimensional learning process. And that's why I have like 1,000 cookbooks and I will still read them and glean them from information because they're full of surprises that you don't know about. Whereas if you're online, you're curating your own knowledge. And after a while, that gets kind of boring for me.
Oh, interesting. Huh. Well, speaking of giving away your recipes for free, let's talk about what pho actually is. We don't have to say how you make it. Everybody can look at the book for that. But what are the basic ingredients? Like what makes pho pho?
Pho, as I have found, and there it's like a word that there's a lot of like pho, 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 pho. There's a lot of like fun pho puns that people have seen all over the place. But when I grew up, I fell for pho when I was about 5.5 years old.
Okay.
And we were still living in Saigon in Vietnam. And my parents took me to like their favorite pho shop. And believe it or not, at that age, I was able to like use chopsticks and a Chinese soup spoon because I was determined to eat that bowl by myself and work my way down to the bottom of the bowl and empty it.
All right.
Because I was so goddamn in love with pho. And when we came here to the U.S., we no longer had the ability to just go out for it. And my mom was always a really good cook. And so pho became for us like this way to experience our heritage because she would make it at home.
Okay.
And she would make it on a Saturday and she would brew the broth. Most of the time it was on beef and on occasion she would make chicken pho. She would brew it on Saturday and her beef pho had like star anise and cinnamon and cloves. She'd roast the onion and the ginger to make sure that it had a little bit of that hint of sweetness. And people are always, you know, I've seen so many recipes where people do not do that charring process of the aromatics. And that is part of the pho flavor.
Okay.
It slowly converts some of the sugars. And I found that you can do that like maybe a day in advance. So you don't have to do it all at once kind of thing. And then she would just brew the broth and strain it and, you know, get all the toppings ready, the meats and stuff. And then we go to church on Sunday morning and we always had to go at 8 o'clock. You know, you get that communion wafer and you're like really hungry and it's stuck to the roof of your mouth.
Yep. Did you stick around for donuts after church? Did you go straight home?
Donuts for us.
Okay.
My sister actually like spent some time working at Winchell's for a few years and during high school. So we're not too much of a donut family. We had a lot of them. And so we would then speed home. Skip the donuts and the coffee. Mm-hmm. And we'd speed home and we'd have a little pho assembly line. And so we had our own little pho restaurant and we were a family of seven. So pho for me was also a very family-oriented experience. So it was culture, it was family, it was noodle soup. But when I started writing this book, I was like, first of all, I really didn't know how I would carry off like a pho cookbook.
Okay.
I've written a number of single subject books like dumplings and tofu and banh mi, but pho is so iconic. I thought, I've got like two recipes.
Okay.
Chicken and beef. And what else could pho possibly be? So, but my publisher said, you can figure something out. Just take some time out and think about it. So I did some research. And what I realized is that pho means two things. It means the noodle soup. And within that noodle soup is wrapped the broth and the flavor of pho. the spices, but and the experience of eating that noodle soup. But aside from the noodle soup, in the Vietnamese culture and culinary repertoire, pho also refers to the noodle themselves, the flat rice noodles. So we have like these pho dishes. If you like start looking at a Vietnamese menu, you'll go, oh, well, there's pho soup. And then look, they have pho stir-fry noodles. They all, it's referring to the pho noodles.
So linguistically, is that something that comes up in Vietnamese sometimes? Because bún, which is the cold vermicelli salad, that but that bún is also that noodle, correct?
Exactly.
So is it just context clues?
It is context clues.
Okay.
And you want to, bún can be, that's just the noodles, but then you're, but the go-to dish is the bún bowl.
Right?
So you're like, oh yeah, we're going to go eat bún. And you're like, well, what kind of bún are you talking about? But most of the time they're talking about that salad, the cold salad thing. With pho, most of the time they're talking about the rice noodle soup. But then there are all of these other pho dishes and that use just the noodles or the spices or the rice noodle sheet. And so then that begged the question of, well, what the hell does the word pho mean? And for years, people were like, oh, well, of course, the French were there. So,
oh, I'm so glad you're bringing this up.
You know, there just must be some je ne sais quoi about pho. And perhaps it's related to pot-au-feu. Pho meaning fire. And
because that is a dish that is a stew and there is some of the roasting of the vegetables before the liquid is added to it. So that's the similarity. It didn't just come out of nowhere, but there is a pattern. We keep coming back to language, but Vietnamese food words are often credited to the French.
Yes. And there are, you know, there are, it's a strange thing, but Vietnam was, you know, officially occupied by the French for, say, you know, like 75 years, roughly 75 years. The Chinese, though, were always there. And they still are, right next door. North of Vietnam, the Chinese are right there.
The way you're saying this, I'm like, oh, yeah, let's get into this. Okay.
Because they've been, you know, and Vietnam was part of China on and off, a colony of China for like 1,000 years.
Right.
And then you've got all of the, you know, intrusion from and the trade and the travel between Vietnam and Thailand, for example, and other parts of Southeast Asia and trade with India. But the Chinese in North Vietnam and, you know, pho originated around Hanoi, so Northern Vietnam. Chinese are right there.
Yeah.
And so I was like trying to figure out, well, where does the word pho come from? And we know that it originated sometime around the beginning of the 20th century. So I went looking for traces of pho, and I found in a, actually it was strangely a collection of wood block prints, wood carving prints. And I bought this book that was like about 2 inches thick at an airport in Vietnam, because I was like, this is such a cool book, and had all these cool drawings and line drawings of old things in Vietnam going on at the beginning of the 20th century. And I had the book for like 5 years, and I loaned it to my parents, and then one day I was like, holy mackerel, it came from this particular set of books that were printed between 1908 and 1909, and it was published, a vanity press, by a French administrator who was living in Hanoi, and he was really fascinated by Vietnamese culture. And so he commanded a bunch of local artisans to go out and draw and carve the Vietnamese life scenes.
And when we say French administrator, like a government official who's been sent to go.
A colonial administrator who's supposed to be doing work. And he's like, no, I'm going to make these books.
Right. I mean, maybe they got paid and he was like a patron of the arts.
Maybe. Yeah. So he had like these books. And so I was like looking through the books and I was looking online and I found images that were, one of the images was of a pho vendor. I read some Chinese, and so in Chinese it says something like beef, itinerant vendor of beef noodles. And when I translated the beef noodles, the word for beef is niu, and the word for noodles is fun. And so there have been essays that have been written in Vietnamese and published and distributed in Vietnam that say that the word pho comes from the Chinese word fun, which means flat rice noodle.
Uh-huh.
And so somehow fun eventually became pho.
Uh-huh.
Because they were sold by street vendors who were like, you know, saying fun, fun, fun. But the thing is that if you say fun and in the wrong way, it can mean shit.
Ah, you got to be careful about that.
So it's like fun versus fun.
Oh.
And fun means...
It means shit.
It means shit or fertilizer. So,
oh my gosh.
So you really have to be careful. So I think, so one of the things is like, they're like, well, maybe it's more practical to switch to pho. So, and Vietnamese language is very funny because there are certain words where I'll ask, like, people of my parents' generation, and my father's a learned man. I'll say, well, where did that word come from? He's like, I don't know.
Huh.
Because it's this amalgam of cultures. And it was based upon Chinese language and Chinese characters in a very unique form of intricate Vietnamese versions of Chinese characters. So the Vietnamese could take like a Chinese character and add more strokes to it.
Huh.
And make it like, oh, it's now Vietnamese. But what happened was it was very difficult for a lot of people to become literate.
Oh, I see.
And okay. So, but then eventually when the French and the Portuguese missionaries came and then they made everything into the Roman alphabet that gave people more literacy, but at the same time, the roots of the terms were kind of lost, or murky, mm-hmm. became very murky.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like no one is quite sure about the history of pho, where it came from exactly, who made it first. But it's somewhat murky, sort of like a really bad bowl of pho broth. But, you know, we're sure that it came about in the northern part of Vietnam at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah. So the origins of it, like you just said, people, I mean, you know, it's noodle soup. So there's probably different elements of it that were added at different times and in different places. But one thing that is much more easily traced is its journey from Hanoi in the north to Saigon in the south and how it changed as it moved southward, which is something that you can speak on, obviously.
Definitely, because there's like this north-south divide. It's almost like Yankee versus, you know, the southern kind of thing. And I don't know, they're always like, I've traveled enough and met enough people in this world where I'm like, why is it always like a north-south thing?
Right?
Right. Is it like, you know, the northerners always tend to be much more traditional and conservative, you know, and purists in a way. And the southerners are like, hey, we're living large.
Right, right.
So what happened was, so here's pho, and it's and you have to remember Vietnam was a pretty rural, you know, country.
Okay.
And so people didn't like get around much.
I see.
So when the country was split in half in 1954, according to the Geneva Accords, so people had this 1 year period where you could decide, do you want to stay in the north and be with more of like the communist part of the country, or do you want to be with the nationalists and more liberal, progressive social and political culture of the South.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this period where you could move and people moved back and forth depending on which side they wanted to be on. So
there was
split.
An official time where they were like, you guys choose, mm-hmm. and then you're cut off and you have to commit to this decision,
exactly.
but you're free to go for the next 6 months or whatever.
Exactly. So my parents, who were both born in northern Vietnam, made that move southward.
Okay.
And so did a lot of other people.
Did anyone move from south to north?
They did.
Okay.
Yeah, and families were split.
Yeah, that's really rough. But as you're about to explain to us, the southern version of pho is much more of a party, which I think is so indicative of like the general personality of the culture.
Right.
Like in Saigon, overall, it's more of a party than in Hanoi. And the food totally reflects that.
Right. It's like people are having a good time, you know, and the bowls got bigger.
Uh-huh.
Right. And the...
They're just adding in herbs, whatever they feel
right.
like.
And like you have like this whole like, you know, hedgerow of like bean sprouts and all different kinds of herbs that the northerners would go, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
And... Even to this day, because in 2015, when I went back to Vietnam to research the book, I met with my relatives, people I'd never met before, but uh-huh. they were like, oh, okay, you want to talk about pho? Fine. So I met with people who were in their 50s in Hanoi, for example, who lived through the whole communist regime and whatnot, and former party members. And they would say things like, it's too damn sweet in the South. And they put all those things in there. they put all of those foreign herbs, is what they said in
Vietnam. Foreign herbs?
Yeah. Like, they're like foreign, meaning that it doesn't belong there.
I see.
Yeah, because like the Thai basil, even though in the U.S. we know it as Thai basil, in Vietnamese, we just call it like cinnamon basil. And people would say, well, you know what that basil's good for? It's good for eating with like dog meat.
Oh, good heavens.
I know. And they're putting that in our pho. And so we have like these Northerners who are really, you know, they're purists, and they still like the smaller portions, the pure flavors. If you're really just going to have hardcore pho, noodles, broth, and cooked beef, not even the raw meat, just the cooked, it's really like subtle and with a little mint and some chilies. But the Northerners like put all this stuff into their pho nowadays. Like, you know, we call them Chinese donuts in the West, but they're like those crullers that the Chinese eat with congee. So they're like dipping that into their pho. They're like sprinkling this garlic vinegar into their pho. You go down in the South, you don't see the garlic vinegar. Sometimes you see the Chinese.
Garlic vinegar sounds amazing,
it's
though.
It's really good.
Oh my gosh.
I really fell in love with that. At first I was like, what the hell is this? And why are these old Hanoi men putting all of this stuff into their pho? Because if they're really like these hardcore people, then like what, you know, why are they adding all of these things?
Maybe they feel like they discovered garlic vinegar. And so they're like, yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
But they don't want to do what those Southerners did.
Right. And the Southerners are just like destroying it because it's sweeter.
Yeah.
And you know, they put all of these other additions in all those like chili sauces and bean sauces like hoisin. It's just like, it just destroys the flavor of pho. And my relatives in the South, and they're in their 70s, they recall a period of like going to the North right after the country reunified. Mm-hmm. So in the late 70s, early 80s. And the North was suffering from a lot of economic problems and agricultural problems. There was still like some rations.
Okay.
So my relatives in the South, like one of them said, well, you know, I went up there. Yeah, to stand in line to get a little ticket. What is that all about? And then they're like, and then she says, and after I got my bowl of pho, I asked for a drink, and they said, you've got to go somewhere else. And she said, that was so uncivilized.
Oh my gosh.
And their broth up there is just so bland.
Wow.
And so there's still like this, you know, and these are people who've lived through a lot. And they still have their little fights about pho.
Yeah, because I feel like fighting about food is something that we can all indulge in at any time, and we all have our preferences, and everyone has something to say about it. That's the very existence of this podcast, obviously.
Right, right. And, you know, it's, and for people who lived in Vietnam and suffered through like this bizarre, you know, period of history that was just very tumultuous, it's now a luxury for them, and I think they revel in it. And anybody who's traveled to Vietnam sees this flourishing. There's like food everywhere.
Yeah.
But there was a time when there was like very little food.
Yeah.
There was very little street food. And, you know, you were thought of like as bougie if you ate out on the street. And my cousin in the North said, you know, no one would eat out on the street because it was dirty. So filthy.
When did that change? Because it's all street food all the time throughout Vietnam.
Right. Because, I mean, now, you know, in 2016, 2017, we're Vietnam now is just this totally, it's a different country in the urban areas and the areas where most of us travel. And we take it for granted, and even people there take it for granted too, that there's a plenitude. We take advantage of that. And a lot of people who go to Vietnam don't even like realize it's a communist country because it seems like it's kind of relaxing, you know, and I'm like, it's a communist country.
Well, so I've only been there once, so I can't really speak to it, but I wonder if those are people who don't go to Hanoi, because Hanoi feels so different even to this day. I think you can really sense the communism in Hanoi in a way that is not present in Saigon at all, culturally speaking. I feel like Saigon is sort of the North and South thing that you said. It feels like Southern Europe. Whereas Hanoi looks more like Europe. I mean, you can go to mausoleums and look at dead people, dead communist leaders, and all the propaganda that they are making money off of now, the posters and stuff like that. It's so it's commercially, but also just like in terms of the soul of the city.
Exactly.
So different than Saigon.
Yeah, but people, you know, they don't quite understand that so much. Or and, you know, there are a lot of people who will go and visit like the Coochie Tunnels, and so there's mm-hmm. the war, but they may not be, a lot of people who go nowadays are not fully aware, I think. And when I went back to Vietnam, because I was just like, okay, do Vietnamese people eat pho every day for breakfast? Does everyone eat pho? Uh-huh. Or is this just like an urban thing?
Okay.
So I found some guys who were in their mid to late 30s, and I said, and they weren't from Hanoi. I met them in Hanoi, and I said, so, you know, when was the first time you had pho? And one of them said to me, he distinctively remembered eating pho in like the mid-80s.
Okay.
When his grandmother could afford the money to send him on a little trip from his village into Hanoi to visit. He had never been to Hanoi before. And he said, I had to take a pedicab and a boat and a bus. And he said, the first time I saw that woman cutting those noodles, hand cutting the pho noodles, and uh-huh. then putting them in the bowl and putting in the broth, he said, I'll never forget it.
Wow.
And the other guy I spoke to said, I came from a small village. We did not have pho. That was considered for rich people and the city people. We didn't have it. And he said, the first time I had pho was when I came to Hanoi to go to university.
Okay.
So we assume that it's something that, you know, is all over Vietnam, but, you know, for a lot of people, it's still something that's special. And when they discover it, they're like, holy mackerel, this is really good.
So expensive is a relative term, of course. But one of the things that people say about the origins of pho, even though given, as we just discussed, it's more Chinese than French, but the French influence came from the addition of beef. Do you feel like that's true?
Yeah, because the Vietnamese were using cows as draft animals.
Yeah, and not really eating them.
Right.
They were work animals.
They were work animals, just like water buffalo were, mm-hmm. you know, and they had this noodle soup that the vendors were making from water buffalo, and they were using the round rice noodles, the bún, and the French really wanted their beef. And so that was, you know, it was like this strange situational thing.
Yeah.
A collision of cultures is how I describe it in the book. And so, you know, there were these tough cuts. There were the bones, and the butchers had to like sell them. So they made a special out of them.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, hey, on sale, street vendors, what can you do with it? We've got a lot. And so the street vendors made the switch to beef from water buffalo to beef. And then somewhere along the line, they switched the noodles from round rice noodles to the flat rice noodles.
Uh-huh.
And then eventually adding, you know, the spicing and stuff. So the thing about the story of pho is that it is evolving.
Yeah.
And I think that in my writing, the pho cookbook, what I'd like to do is to engage people in participating in that evolving story. Because we think of, a lot of people think of pho as like beef, and some people don't even know that a chicken version exists.
Okay.
And then there are the people who are like, a vegetarian version? What the hell? And I'm like, we got Buddhists.
Right. People who get offended about vegetarian options get real offended about vegetarian options. They take it as a personal affront. It's like, it's fine.
It's fine.
It's going to be okay.
Right. And then you go to pho restaurants, and, you know, there have been... I've seen seafood versions mm-hmm. of pho. I've seen lobster pho in the United States.
Mm.
But in Vietnam, they've actually been like pushing the pho envelope even a little bit more.
Ooh.
And even though we think of like, oh, well, you know, they're just like these people who are so traditional, and they seem perhaps some people, you know, as being such like these hardcore, you know, purist types. But in Hanoi, this is a thing that really is like interesting to me. So they have like these pho noodle rolls called pho cuong in Hanoi. And it's like a young person's thing. It's a snack. And so it's a rice noodle sheet. And you like have a tiny bit of stir fried beef in there and lettuce and herbs. And it's rolled up. It looks almost like a soft taco or a taquito kind of shape.
Okay.
And then it's eaten with the Vietnamese nước chấm dipping sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousin, one of my cousins, he was like, oh yeah, my daughter really likes that. And she's like a teenager. Uh-huh. And they go to this one particular area in Hanoi to have it. And there's like, you know, probably like 10 vendors who sell it. And they, you know, they hang out with their friends. And so that's pho kung. Uh-huh. Those are like pho rice noodle rolls. And so I came up with a recipe for that. And then they're also coloring pho noodles in Saigon. They're like,
oh, using like rainbow bagels.
Exactly. And then there's brown rice pho noodles. Uh-huh. I've had deep fried pho noodles that have like a saucy stir fry on top.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, that would be like deep fried pho.
Right. Well, okay. I really like hearing this because obviously, I love talking about food. I do it professionally. But one thing that I've never understood is when people get angry about it. And I think that where people get hung up on things when they're talking about food is the question of authenticity. So if the country of origin of a particular food is doing whatever they want with it, why can't everyone else? And I feel like when we talk about authenticity, we're sort of robbing ourselves of like the bigger picture.
Right.
In a way.
Yeah. And I think that once that you start talking about authenticity, you start kind of marching down or slipping down a very slippery slope. Because for me, authenticity relies upon the notion that someone understands the foundation of an authenticity in food, understands the foundation of particular food. And then another thing about authenticity is that, are they true? Are they honest in their riffs? So it's got to be based upon something.
Okay.
So for these people in Vietnam to be, say, you know, to create these new thing versions of pho, they know there, it's like the pho experience is part of their blood, and perhaps they're like, we're kind of tired of the traditional pho experience. Mm-hmm. What else can we do with it?
Mm-hmm.
So in the sense of in like pho, what does pho mean? Okay, pho means the noodle soup, but pho also means the rice noodle itself. What is the rice noodle made out of? It's made out of a steamed rice noodle sheet that is then cut. So then if you've got the steamed rice noodle sheet, why can't you like put some things in there and roll it up? And then you've got pho kung, a rolled pho.
Yeah.
Or a rolled noodle thing.
Yeah. So because I'm an Instagram creeper, I know that today you had a pho rito, which is this item that a guy who has a very good food truck in LA created. And it's funny because as much as I'm like, fuck authenticity, that's not really a thing, I also don't like gimmicky food. So the burrito like kind of reminded me of like a ramen burger, in which I'm like, I don't need to try that. That's fine. But you didn't hate the burrito.
No. Well, at first I thought, okay, you know, it's like double dipping in carbs.
Right.
It's like you got your rice, you're wrapped in a, you know, flour tortilla.
Yeah.
And then I had read up on the chef, and he's like Singaporean background, I believe, and making the food of Indonesia and Malaysia. And I've traveled to that part of the world. And I was like, well, this is interesting because, you know, he's looking for a way to bring people in to his restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, okay, let's go try this out. And when it was presented to us, and it's like an $11 burrito, so it's not.
Which is also weird in California.
It is. It's a high end burrito,
which
is actually expensive for pho.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So all of a sudden, you're taking like two of what people consider as like cheap eats, mashing them up.
And he like added the prices of them together.
Right. Right. So we get it, and it's large, it's sizable. And first bite, I was like, oh, he's creating a riff on Singaporean Fukinese popia, which is a street food. And so popia is like you take a very thin wheat. It's like, think of like a mushu wrapper.
Okay.
All right. And you can smear a little hoisin in there. You can have a little chili sauce in there. And then there's like bean sprouts, and then there's egg, and then there's Chinese sweet sausage, lap chong, and other stuff. And when you go get it, you order like two or three per order, and they're the size of like a really fat egg roll.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sweet, it's spicy, and it's a little crunchy. And I was like, oh, he's like put pho ingredients in a tortilla, which is very much like a popiah that you would get in Singapore. And the chiu chow, I saw this whole thread of food history from southern, from like southeastern China going through like, you know, the waters of, you know, down through trade to Vietnam, through Southeast Asia, and then it comes back to America in the form of a burrito.
I bet that most people eating the burrito, obviously, would not have the same thought process that you would, I guess. But, like, if it tastes good, and there
it,
you go.
And it actually really worked. I mean, I was like, I taste the pho. It lingers on my lips. He's got the Thai basil in there. He's using really high-quality bean sprouts. His noodles are good. You know, he does this thing where the beef tastes like pho. He's using, like, I think it's like brisket or something in there.
Uh-huh.
And it all came together very well. Nice. So, you know, props to him.
Yeah, that's awesome. By the way, this is the Komodo food truck, if anyone is in LA and wants to check it out. Was it at the truck or the brick and mortar
location? It was at the brick and mortar. Okay. And the thing that is so amazing about that burrito is that I saw a website post in Vietnam on the burrito and where they explain what a burrito is.
Yes.
As being like this food from Mexico.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And then they had a video of him demoing how to make it. So you know, my friends, burrito is probably in Saigon right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that is so cool. I love thinking about like what we know versus like what other people in other parts of the world know. But actually, speaking of which, a few months ago, Bon Appetit posted a video about... Okay. We'll start at the beginning because this like takes all kinds of twists and turns. But they posted a video that was called something like, this is how to make and eat pho, and if you don't do it this way, you're a dick, essentially. And they had a white chef who owns a, I believe, Vietnamese or maybe Pan-Asian restaurant in, I think, Philadelphia. And he was saying things like, you have to add hoisin and you have to twirl it around the chopsticks like this and it has to be XYZ, otherwise it's not done right. And they posted the video as such. And they got so much backlash for that. It turns out that they maybe edited it in a way that the chef didn't intend to present it as, which I really hesitate to defend a white guy. But like, I know other chefs have reached out to him and said, God, he was just saying that this is the way he likes to eat pho. He wasn't trying to make any pronouncements. But what, I mean... Bon Appetit really effed up on that one.
They did. They kind of, people, a lot of Asians spoke up, and I think maybe Bon Appetit didn't realize the kind of fire they'd light. And maybe they didn't realize, I think they learned something about their constituency. And a lot of millennials got really pissed off. Mm-hmm. Because it was like, don't tell me how to eat my pho. And I watched the video and it was pretty tame. And the chef was like, this is how I like to do it. And then he's got like this chopstick twirling move.
Uh-huh.
And people were like, holy mackerel, he's eating pasta with chopsticks. And, you know, and he's trying to pay respects. But like, it was just edited where he didn't give you a sense of his connection to pho and why he likes it. And he's got a restaurant that's like this Asian fusion place.
Okay.
And I think that he was, you know, looking to get some attention to his restaurant.
Sure.
And I hear that he's a good chef, and he reached out to me and...
Oh, he did.
Yeah. And he apologized because...
Oh, that kind of breaks my heart.
Yeah. And I was like, it's okay. I understand. And I, you know, but I was just like, I thought, and people accused Bon Appetit of whitewashing pho, mm-hmm. and they could have taken steps to, let's say, have the chef discuss pho or his method of eating pho with like a Vietnamese chef,
mm-hmm.
who, and you can find them, they speak English, you know, and
gosh.
And like it would be a really great conversation, but it was instead just this very kind of like very, you know, sterile. It was sterile.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, people really took that to task. And he was like, don't put hoisin, don't put sriracha in your pho because it'll ruin the broth, which is something I tell people. But I also tell people that this is how I eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm going to have sriracha and hoisin, I often like to have it on a side dish and to like dip my meat in mm-hmm. or my meatballs. And, you know, it's like, there are so many ways to eat pho. But
right.
I think that he was just the wrong messenger.
Right.
And the way that that video was framed, my goodness, it was just, you know, Bon Appetit took it down. They issued 2 apologies. Mm-hmm. People reached out to me from the press. And I was just like, this is really interesting because pho has become the embodiment of many things to people in this country as being this Vietnamese food of like being owned by Vietnamese people, but yet also being something that people will share. So what I found to be fascinating is that, well, the other thing that they didn't like is how Bon Appetit framed pho as a new ramen.
Yeah. I mean, what the hell is that?
Well, why? So it's like we Asians only get one soup.
One soup at a time. That's
one
it.
One soup at a
you
time,
can switch
baby.
Every 20 years.
Right.
That's it.
No, we'll go to cold Sichuan cold noodles some other time.
Right.
But one, you know, ramen's out, pho's in. And it's like Asia's not monolithic. And, you know, my question has always been like, would they have treated like something, you know, Italian versus French food in the same way?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a lot of lack of understanding about Asian food still, and it seems very mysterious. And so it's like, we got to do something on pho. And, you know, because Lucky Peach magazine did an entire issue mm-hmm. on pho. And so, you know, it was like, well, Bon Appetit saw that, and it was on the rise too, and it still is. So they saw that opportunity as well. Most recently, I watched an episode of network television for a show called Kevin Can Wait.
Kevin Can Wait.
On CBS.
Okay.
And they have an episode called The Fantastic Pho.
Okay.
Where Kevin is totally like...
Is it Kevin James? Is
yes.
That? Okay.
It's really good. And they... and it was... It's like old school, you know, good Hollywood sitcom writing.
Okay.
And it's very sweet. But they got all the cultural nuances right about pho, about how to say it.
Wow.
And he includes like this really wacko Hanoi ingredient they mentioned in it called peanut worms.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And after I watched the episode, I emailed Peter Meehan at Lucky Peach, and I'm like, you know those peanut worms, it's because like you discussed them in Lucky Peach.
Oh, because, funny.
Yeah, because I've been talking about peanut worms for years, but I mean it's like I'm in my little tiny corner.
Okay.
But you know, it's like really cool because they had like this little, so Kevin James like quits his job at the supermarket where he's like a security guy.
Okay.
And he's like, I'm going to open up a food truck kind of thing. And his wife introduces him to pho. Well, his wife introduces him to pho and he's like, never eaten it before. And he's like looking at the hamburger shop across the way.
Uh-huh.
And he tries the pho and he's like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then he gets this idea to start a food truck and introduces his buddies to it. And they all pony up money and they hire an Asian guy to make the pho based upon like his mother's recipe.
Okay.
And then, you know, all these twists and turns happen, but he has a success with this food truck, this pho food truck.
Okay.
And in the end, even though, and then the Asian guy gets mad, the chef, and quits. And so he's like, we're going to pivot and go to chili. And his friends are like, but we like pho. And they were like, you know, and it's like, and the way that Kevin James introduces pho to his friends, he says, I'm going to teach you a little something about Vietnam. It used to be our enemy, but now it's our friend.
You know, that sounds like telegraphing to me, like the writer's room. We're like, you know, this is something that we need to bring to Middle America, and this is how we want to present it.
It was a fascinating show. I mean, I never thought that pho would be the subject of an entire food quarterly like Lucky Peach, or uh-huh. would it be the subject of a network TV episode.
Well, how do you feel about its increasing popularity?
I think it's great because, mm-hmm. And it's happened fairly rapidly if you were to like, you know, trace like any other kind of ethnic food.
Actually, funny you should mention that because I wrote a brief blurb for the LA Weekly about this place called Pho Filet 2 that's out in the San Gabriel Valley. And while I was like Googling it, I came across an article from Jonathan Gold, who was the legendary food critic who was at LA Weekly before I ever got there. It was from 2008, maybe 2006, and it described what pho is.
Yes.
And I was like, damn, an LA publication describing what this is 8 years ago. That's so crazy. That moved so quickly.
It really, really did. And out in the San Gabriel Valley, when Jonathan wrote that piece, there was like this stretch of road where there were like five or six pho shops. And that young man at Pho Filet was like, did this crazy thing, this Hanoi style, where he was like, had the filet, and then he would like bang on it with the back of his cleaver. You could hear him, like, if you ordered, you'd hear him like thump,
yeah,
in the back, just like you'd hear in Vietnam. And the reason why they do that with the back of their cleaver in Vietnam is because the meat's really tough.
Okay.
We don't have that problem in the U.S.
Sure, yeah.
But anyway, so he did that, and then he had like this little bit of fresh ginger that he added to his bowl for fragrance, which they do in old school shops in Hanoi. So I really, you know, he did a really great job, but I think it got very difficult for him to keep that shop open. So I actually read your piece, and I was very happy to see that there was like this revival.
Okay, good. Good. Yeah. It was a good restaurant, but I don't know if you remember the piece, but I did think that like the other dishes were actually better than the pho.
I kind of feel, because when he had like the first pho filet, that was just like it. There wasn't much else going on. And so like maybe, well, he's older now. It's
years. I mean, maybe he got bored of pho and he was like, let's do all this other thing. Because here's a weird thing. I really love Vietnamese food. It might be like my favorite in so much as you can say something like that.
Thank you.
I feel like pho doesn't necessarily taste like all the other elements of Vietnamese food, though.
It's its own animal.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to pinpoint. It actually, in many ways, embodies Vietnamese food in this sense that it's much more than what the ingredients are. So it's like 2 + 2 = 5 or mm-hmm. 6.
Okay.
Yeah. And to quote my dear friend, Paula Wolford, because it's, when you take a look at the ingredients, they're not, and it's not tricky to make once that you start your, because I tell people, I'm like, if you can boil water, you can make pho. You just need to know like the, you know, some why things are done.
Okay.
And how they're done. But if you can boil water, seriously, you can make pho. Because I've taught a lot of people to make pho, and you know, there are easy pho that you can make, you know, with like by doctoring up broth. There's like pressure cooker pho, then there's like old school pho. And I now make pho like my mom like doesn't even want to make her own pho anymore. She's like,
because yours is better.
Yeah,
that's the ultimate compliment.
I know, right?
Yeah.
And my dad recently got a really great bill of health from his cardiologist, and my mom goes, so she calls me, she says, so after we came back from the cardiologist, Dad said, I want to eat pho. Will you thaw Andrea's pho in the freezer? Because I give him like a frozen pho packet. So she called and she goes, and it was really good.
Oh, that's a huge compliment. We actually have a good number of listeners in South Korea. And one thing that I've noticed about pho in California is that oftentimes pho restaurants are owned by Koreans. I know that there's always been a little bit of tension about Korean-owned sushi restaurants. Is that the same for Korean-owned Vietnamese restaurants? Or is it just like a celebration?
I think it's a celebration. And I remember years ago, Koreatown had a number of pho shops here in LA. And I have a dear friend who lives in South Korea, lives in Seoul, and his father was like a military attaché for South Korea in Saigon during the 60s and 70s.
Ooh, exciting times.
Right. I know. He was jailed after 75, but
goodness.
Anyway, so, but they fell in love with Vietnamese food, that family. And they make it. And Yun Ho told me that there's like an area outside of Seoul where you can go and like get Vietnamese food. And also, but in modern times, there has been a lot of investment in Vietnam by South Koreans.
Okay.
So, you know, people in Vietnam, Vietnamese people, like there were like a number of them, you know, who wanted to do business with Korea, and they would like learn Korean. And, you know, the Koreans were in there doing business because they saw that there was a lot of trade possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, like, Koreans are also like using Vietnamese fish sauce in their cooking and in kimchi.
Because fish sauce is amazing. Don't like go buy a bottle of it and think that you're going to drink it straight. But boy, is it a fantastic ingredient.
Right, right. And so, you know, I think that I don't see as many Korean Vietnam pho shops in Koreatown anymore because there's now this, you know, we've had like this wave of authentic and modern Korean food led by what's happening here in Los Angeles too.
I mean all eating in America is led by true. Los Angeles.
Finally the rest of the country has caught up,
right?
And but one of the things I noticed was that there would be like sides of kimchi served with the pho at these shops in Koreatown. And it was like really interesting. I tried it out, I remember years ago, and I was like, hey, that's kind of cool.
That makes sense. If you want a little like spice with your meal or maybe like a little textural difference, that makes a lot of sense. One thing I've wanted to do is eat Vietnamese food in Paris, but I haven't been able to do it yet. But I just think it would be really interesting to see. I mean, I'm familiar with Vietnamese through the like American filter, but to see it through the French filter, be fascinating.
I've heard it's gotten really good.
Okay.
I remember I haven't been back to France in a long time because I've been traveling mostly in Asia, but reports from my friends say that there's a lot of really good Vietnamese flavors in France right now. It used to be that it was kind of bland and done in kind of like this very smooth, delicate manner to go with the French palate. But in recent times, I think everybody wants bolder food, bolder flavors now.
Mm-hmm.
So in response, I think that the Vietnamese food has certainly, risen also in terms of bold flavors. And there's like people send me emails like from all over the place, like Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
And they're like, we have pho.
Listen, the thing is that it's really good. So why not? And we live in like a global world now. And I do think that, you know, generally speaking, people's palates are becoming more sophisticated as people move into different countries and they bring their food with them and it all goes back and forth.
I also think that nowadays, young people, millennials, they see no borders between mm-hmm. cultures. And people are much more open. And there's this fluid movement of ideas.
Yeah.
And there's this curiosity. And, and they're willing to go places to try new things. So I think that that's really driving the interest in something like pho. I've had, like, reporters say to me, why pho? Why pho? And I'm like, why not?
Yeah. Seriously, you why know? Not?
Why not?
It tastes good.
It tastes good. It's noodle soup. It's gluten-free. It's healthy.
Uh-huh.
You can have it your way.
Yeah.
It's infinitely customizable, personalizable, and it's infinite, and it's oftentimes affordable.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are all good reasons why anyone would want to eat it. Speaking of smashing up cultures, in your pho cookbook, you have a recipe for pho micheladas, which cracks me up.
I know. Well, I went to Vietnam going, okay, I need to just see what my people in the motherland, what they're doing with pho. And so I go to Hanoi, right? The pillar of Vietnamese culture, mm-hmm. where it all started, they love to say. And I had like these two friends, and one of them's an Aussie expat, and the other one is a local Vietnamese guy, and they lead these fabulous food tours in Hanoi, and they're like, you gotta go and have the pho cocktail. I was like, what? They're like, yeah. This bartender makes this pho cocktail. And he owns a bar now, but he made it originally for the Metropole Hotel, which is like this this storied, historic, beautiful, beautiful colonial era hotel in the middle of Hanoi.
Uh-huh.
So my friend Karen Shinto, my travel buddy and stylist, and I went there and one night and we watched this guy make this cocktail. And it was like this entire show where they set up like these three tiers of like metal cups and they like put the spices in the metal cups and then they poured gin through there and like lit it on fire.
Ooh.
And it went over and over and over. And then they like served it with like pho herbs and chili. And I was like, Vietnamese people are, they're very, they love the drama and they're very sentimental and philosophical. And this young man who had come up with the pho cocktail, he thought about like what it was like, and he called it the Joan Baez originally because he thought, and there's fire, flames are going, okay? So he was thinking of like the bombs falling on Hanoi while Joan Baez was there doing her protest thing. And he's wow. like completely inspired to create this cocktail.
Wow. That yeah. goes deep.
Really deep. So it's not, that's the level of authenticity that I'm talking about. It's not just like, you know, like, ooh, I know pho. It's not just like this superficial thing. It's like people really put a lot of thought into it.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so I thought, all right, let's make some cocktails. Because what happens is over the years of being in Asian food and particularly in the Vietnamese food space, people have said to me, I want to make pho. And I want to make an entire meal so that I can entertain people.
Okay.
And I would be like, but pho is a meal in and of itself. And but they're like, no, it's really special. And these are non-Vietnamese people are asking me. Uh-huh. And they're like, I want to do, you know, I want to be respectful of your culture and your food. Uh-huh. So what else can I do? How do I build an entire meal? So part of the book is having, you know, the main courses and then also having what I call sidekicks. There's this chapter called sidekicks. And the sidekicks includes like snacks and salads as well as cocktails and coffee beverages so that you can really create a pho celebration. So I have a friend named Jeff Boreas who is like a beverage master. So he helped me with a pho cocktail that has cognac in it because he then started thinking about the history of pho and the flavors and all this stuff. And so he helped me with two cocktails and I'm like, I can handle the third one. So I thought about like a beer cocktail because in Vietnam, as you know, what do we drink? But like beer on ice, baby.
Yeah.
Right?
It's all like, the time.
All the time. It's like adult soda because it's really light beer.
Yeah. Pretty accurate.
Right. So then I was like searching. I'm like, can I make a michelada? And I didn't know because what would make it pho-ish? Because a lot in the book, a lot of times I'm like, what will make this pho-like? What would make this pho-ish? What will give me the pho experience? So I wrote a friend of mine who's based in LA, Javier Cabral.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He has he's known as the Glutster. But I'm like, so Javier, so, you know, so I want to do this Vietnamese Mexican beer cocktail. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, yeah, no problem. Because he had seen a version done in Guadalajara where they use like broth.
Okay.
So there's like some pho broth in that cocktail.
Yeah. Oh, I bet.
And it's really good. And it's got a rim of pho spices.
That's a delight.
And so that's the last recipe in the book. And I placed it there because I wanted people to understand, number one, like the trajectory of pho being mm-hmm. this very global food. Mm-hmm. And also here in America, a lot of the people who are serving pho and also making pho and eating pho nowadays, it's not just Vietnamese people. It's also a lot of Latinos mm-hmm. also and people of many different backgrounds. But I remembered going back to your comment about Jonathan Gold's article, after I went to that part of El Monte is mm-hmm. where the town is to eat pho after he wrote that piece. And there was in one particular pho shop, there was a guy who was in charge. He was managing the floor and he was Latino. Mm-hmm. Spoke Vietnamese like a charm.
Dope. I love that.
Yeah. And I'm like, that is the future of pho.
Yes.
Right there.
It's the future of California, like overall. Yeah. Oh, so great. And hopefully all of America. Everybody I know, I'm really California centric. I'm just really excited about it right now. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today. Everyone can find her book, The Pho Cookbook, Amazon and fine book retailers everywhere.
Everywhere where books are sold.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
Jeff. Back in the town. Call up the goons, bring the Honda around, my dude, give it some room. For a 6-foot producer with the real heavy appetite, I got a hankering, I'm trying to get my tummy right. With some rice noodles, in some beef broth, basil in the mint leaves, drown in the hoisin sauce. When you want it, not really much to say. We eat a big bowl and go smell like it all day. Bean sprouts with a pinch of little lime, got me feeling kind of fresh, thinking about the next time. Home at the crib, stuffy head, sick with the cold, take the chicken noodle soup can and throw it out, bro. You under the weather, boo-boo, you need this hit. A boiling broth full of the beef brisket, and it don't rhyme with yo, so quit the perpetrating there and get a bowl of Vietnamese noodle soup, player. What's up, dude? We eat pho, dude. You like tripe? Yeah, alright, so do we too. If you come to the town, I'll probably see you. If you really down with the ill bit food, cause it's real, dude, how I feel, dude. When the noodles get hot, they're kinda see-through. You give my partner a call, he can commit you to go and get you a bowl, because you need to. My, oh my, we're gonna hit the first spot, gonna get fur tie like la la, ooh la la. We cop a can of Thai tea at the Viet Wah, or oh boy, some yayo soy. If you don't want boat, then get the ganoy. A couple of squirts of that sriracha sauce, make it nicely spicy, have you feeling like a boss.
A Table Cakes production.